This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Thomas Scheff. I've been teaching at UCSB for 50 years. And one of my projects has been to try to understand what's called senseless violence. Today I'm going to talk about one kind of senseless violence, mass killings at schools, particularly in the United States, where they're more frequent than in other countries. I'm going to be very brief. I'm just going to outline my approach. And if I go more than 15 minutes, please interrupt me, because I'd like to have discussion. The reason is that I don't like lecturing anymore. I teach all my classes using the discussion method. But also, the field that I've been studying, the field of emotional causes of behavior, is a fairly new field. And there's not much known as a field. There are now quite a number of people studying emotions. But so far, they all have sort of separate opinions. And so what you're getting from me is an opinion. I don't represent any larger school of thought even. Please feel free to question me about something that you don't understand or disagree with. I've been interested in the field of violence all these years, not just for scholarly reasons, but also as a practical problem. The killing in Isla Vista is an example. And so I'm wondering if we understand senseless violence better, perhaps there's something we can do about it. And I want to get to that, my suggestions today. One of the more obvious things in the manifestos and letters that the mass killers have written is that they are talking a lot about emotions. The killer in Isla Vista, for example, he wrote 141 pages explaining his position, and that 141 pages is full of what you might call emotion words. He talks about his anger, to a lesser extent his sadness, and crying. But there's one emotion that he talks about the most. He explains that he has felt rejected for most of his life. And that occurs quite frequently. I think there are at least 30 times where he talks about feeling rejected. And some other expressions in the same vein. So it far outnumbers the other emotions. So I want to look at that, and it's true in other mass killers too. And also, there's all other kinds of senseless violence besides mass school killings. There's what's called familicide, where one parent kills the other parent and the children, and sometimes him or herself. And then there's the work world shootings. So there are various kinds of mass violence, of which school killings are only one. There's a very good book on familicide by a sociologist in which she had the temerity to go further than just what the media reports were. He has, I think, 211 cases of familicides in the United States. And he was able to get to a lot of data that was gathered afterwards by an organization by questioning the neighbors and the family remainders, the family. So he has quite a lot of material about familicide. And my understanding fits with his very well. Now, the feeling of acceptance or rejection by others, I think, is not a mere emotion, as the popular song says, But it's a mammalian instinct that is the most primitive of all the feelings, because for a mammal to survive, it has to be accepted by the herd, by the troop, the group, the community. And so there's an instinctive reaction to the possibility of rejection, not just the rejection itself. So what these killers are talking about is a primitive emotion, and I'm not going to tell you the word I put on it yet. I don't want to shock you. I'll warm you up a little bit before I tell you what word I think that is. I want to tell you about a systematic study of emotion episodes in psychotherapy that was published as a book in 1971. Many years ago, by a psychoanalyst by the name of Helen Block Lewis. What she did was she got about 150 other therapists to record 10 each of their sessions. I didn't say that right. There are 10 other therapists besides herself. She got them to record about 15 of their sessions. So she had 150 recordings of psychotherapy sessions. She had those transcribed, and then she applied a systematic method to finding emotion words in this text. It's called a Gottschalk-Glaser. It's still being used today. It was very young when she adopted it in 71. It had just come out, 1969. And what they do is they look for words that usually signify emotion. For example, if someone says, "I'm pissed off," I think everybody would understand that that means they're angry. They're saying they're angry. I told my students once that if they say, "I'm hot under the collar," and they laughed at me because they said, "We don't talk that way anymore." And I said, "Well, what do you say?" They say, "I'm pissed off." Okay. There are words signifying sadness, for instance, crying. There are words signifying fear, although those come up less frequently in psychotherapy sessions. But then there are words, lots of words, like feelings of rejection. And in fact, those were the champions. They were more of those kind of words than all the other emotion episodes combined in these 150 sessions. For example, a patient would say, "This is an awkward moment for me." That signifies the same emotion. Feeling rejected is another way of saying it. It's a very common way. And so what are we going to call that emotion? Because it turns out that there are two surprises about it. First of all, it's by far the most frequently occurring episode in these 150 sessions. And secondly, unlike the episodes, it never gets talked about. Both the therapist and the client seem not to notice those episodes. So Helen Lewis, she didn't know whether they didn't notice because they didn't notice, they weren't aware, or because they noticed but didn't say anything, which would, of course, be very strange for the therapist. So she was a practicing psychoanalyst, so in her practice, she started asking her clients when they used one of these words, and she found out they were unaware of it. They didn't realize that they were talking about an emotional state. You want to hazard a guess at the name of this emotion? Did I hear someone say something?
Shame.
Yeah, shame. I call it the S word because people don't like talk about it. It's like the F word. Probably just as forbidden, as taboo, as the F word. And I've been talking about it for 30 or 40 years, and people say to me, "What's all this about shame? I'm not ashamed." And I would like to say to them, well, that's part of the problem. You don't know that you're a sin. But I say, and then I said, well, good for you. I try to be agreeable. So what she did was, Helen, she saw that when they talk about sadness, she called it sequences, that a sequence episode would often sequence into discussion. And after the discussion, the client seemed somewhat relieved. And then the anger episodes, they would often sequence into discussion. And then usually the client seemed relieved. But of course, the shame episodes didn't sequence in the discussion because neither the client nor the therapist noticed them. You got that? Okay. If the shame sequenced into anger, then the anger would be discussed, but not the shame. The most frequent sequence, she said, she counted, for shame was withdrawal. The patient would slow down, become less verbal, and then that might be talked about, or it might not be. Yeah, so that would be talked about. You know, what's happening? What's happening to you right now? Just talk about that. And then sometimes a therapist seemingly could talk the client out of this withdrawal. So the shame reaction is not being given the therapeutic treatment in these 150 sessions, not once. Okay, I'm moving right along here, and I have one or two more things to say. Sometimes emotions can cause other emotions, both within the person and between persons. I call these loops. For example, a fire panic, people are afraid, and they see they're afraid, and they become more afraid. People are, and they see other people becoming afraid, and that makes them more afraid, and they get into a loop and can panic and run over people, walk, you know. So it can get very intense, these loops. And I think shame loops like that also in two different ways. There's a shame loop. I see it sometimes when my students are talking about blushing. They say, blushing is a terror to me. I say, why? I say, well, when I realize I'm blushing, I blush some more. And I say, and then? They say, and then I blush some more. And so it goes on and on until I have to sort of withdraw. And I heard an actor talking about missing his lines one time and going through one of those loops. He had to be carried off the stage. He lost control. Well, I think shame loops, as in blushing, are the cause not only of withdrawal, but if the person gets caught up in them, of depression. It's a theory of depression based on shame sequences. And the other direction, and much less frequently, is shame-anger. And I think that shame-anger sequences, a person can get caught up in anger, aggression, and violence. Unaware shame. Honor is a 19th century idea about hiding humiliation behind anger and aggression. Honor, protecting your honor. Prison convicts who are convicted of murder, they don't use the word honor. They say, the psychiatrist says to them, why did you kill him? He said, what do you mean? He dissed me. That's a modern version of honor. okay? He discredited me. He disrespected me. That's about honor. Very big, especially with men. Males are taught to defend their honor. And, of course, in these mass killings, much more men involved than women. There's an occasional woman, but it's almost all male. Okay. Well, supposing that this answer about hiding humiliation behind aggression and violence has some truth to it for some of these killings, what can we do as a society to reduce them? And I have a couple ideas I want to throw out to you, see what your reaction is. There is a new type of educational approach now that's being used in some parts of the United States, at least, called cooperative learning, where the idea is to get away from completely individualistic learning and grading into cooperative learning and grading. You assign students to teams, beginning in the first grade, and you grade the team so that they're learning to get along together and perhaps to be friends. And that's in use now in some school districts. And I think that's a step in the right direction. Another step, beginning in the first grade, would be what I call speed friending. I haven't heard of anybody else with this idea, but you remember a TV show called Speed Dating? Anybody remember that? You get a bunch of men and women together, equal numbers, and you have them talk to each other for 5 minutes. And if there are 10 of each, then you get to talk to 10 and then choose the one that you want to date. Speed dating. Okay, speed friending in the first grade, you have same thing, except it's not about dating, but picking out a friend. And then do this every year through high school and into college. Think of a university that would be willing to do that. Speed friending. But it's a way of reducing isolation, sociologists call it, loneliness, and feelings of rejection. It's an idea.
How do you tell if someone just doesn't like interaction? They're a normal person, they're just particularly shy, or, you know, I mean, there are people that rarely maybe choose to live alone, like hermits or something. I mean, yes. How would you differentiate between those two types of behaviors?
Well, shyness is an aspect of shame, pride dimension. I didn't mention pride. The English language is very tough on that word because they mix it up with egotism, which is a great mistake. But pride is a feeling of acceptance, and it's part of love, I think. I have a book about that. So everybody needs to feel pride, to connect with at least one other person in the world, or else they're alone. So shyness is a way of talking about navigating the shame-pride axis. And some people do it better than others. But everyone needs at least one friend. I'm pretty sure of that. And if they don't, even if they don't think they want that friend, there's still consequences. People need to connect with at least one other person. It would be better yet to collect to a group. But in modern individualistic societies, it's getting harder and harder to do. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Oh. Yes.
Just following up on Lisa's question, so do you believe that everyone starts with sort of the same baseline for emotion, or do you believe there are people that are more predisposed to be less attached or shyer? How do you believe that works?
I haven't thought much about that. I just assume that there is a shame instinct in everyone, an anger instinct, but their training leads to different ways of acting on it. In modern societies, men are encouraged to show anger and women discouraged. And it doesn't help either one of them, anger, actually. But, of course, a lot depends on how you show the anger. I first came in contact with Helen Lewis because I read a line of hers in this book. I had had some of my own emotional experiences, and I got interested in studying emotion, so I came across a book of hers, which I found hard to understand. But there was a line in it about the idea that shame can sequence to anger. And now I've forgotten your question. Ask again.
Just whether you think everyone has the same kind of emotional baseline that they start from.
Yes, I think so. I think it's mammalian instinct to want to be accepted by the group or herd because, you know, until you're a certain age, that's life. Your life depends on it. You have to be taken care of. And then after that, I would say having a entertaining or interesting life depends on it. But in modern societies, there's so much emphasis on the individual and on breaking away from ties that might keep you from getting ahead that we've kind of lost track of that. It's really hard to talk about. I have to make up official words to talk about it. You can talk about loneliness. But the idea of disconnect can happen. It's an idea that has to be invented because individual societies don't assume it. They assume disconnect. An individual, complete in themselves, can get ahead without worrying about the family. Is that idea coming across in China now of individualism? We have a guest from China.
Thank you. Because I come to here just 1 month, so I couldn't completely understand what you said. But I have a question. How to prevent this question? Do you give some suggestion?
Could someone, my hearing is very poor.
How do you prevent these kinds of mass killings?
Yeah. Yes, well, this idea of making friends beginning at 6 or 7 years old is a start. Cooperative learning, which doesn't emphasize individual grading entirely and competition. See, modern societies are built on competition. You're competing all the time. But there has to be some limit to that if people are going to be happy and behave themselves. You need to have one friend. See, my reading of these manuscripts that I've been looking at of these mass killers, they didn't have a single friend in the world. They were broken off from their family. They were disconnected from their family and no friends. And it seemed to me, in that situation, without someone to talk to about your troubles, it would be very easy to get lost in one of these loops. So you have to go step back a minute from the arch individualistic society that China is becoming at this very moment. You have to step back a minute and keep something for friendship. For social connections, not just with individuals, but maybe with groups. They ought to have speed friending with groups for individuals in modern societies because there's trouble when people don't have friends and groups. Yeah.
I just want to push back on that, actually, a little bit. The idea that the solution is in bonding, having some kind of thickening of ties. I think there's been a bit of work that suggests that a lot of this has to do with perceptions and not realities, right? So the world that people inhabit is the world of their mind, right? So a lot of people, a lot of these mass shootings, in reality, these people have plenty of friends. And if you look at the diaries of Columbine and if you look at the reality, there wasn't the degree of social isolation, in fact, in terms of contact, in terms of hanging out, in terms of the sort of things that are the relational correlates of, for most people, positive sentiments, right? That instead, what's missing is there's a perception of alienation from the group. So I'm wanting to complicate this by interjecting that there is an idea of what it means, right? The social construction of being a member of a group, and that is mediating a lot of this to the extent that that, for example, having sex and partying and getting drunk and sort of a whole sort of host of things that have become the idea of Isla Vista, right? That's what it means to be here, right? And that a sense of alienation from that, right, is, I think, so I'm throwing that out there as I think that on one level, obviously, there's the reality of contact, interaction, but then there's also that, you know, nothing is real except the mind doth make it so, right? We know this as sociologists, right? So I think that there's this complication, which is that the culture and institutions make a setting for what it means, what it means to be part of the group.
Yeah. Yes, a good example of what you're saying is this fellow who killed two people in a school in Washington State recently. He was like the most popular guy in school. So this is a complicated matter, and you've indicated one of the complications, which is the social construction of connectedness that the society introduces. But you can go a little further than that, though, in complexity. There was a study done here by two of my colleagues, Zimmerman and Wilson. They studied the gap in conversations with 20 adult conversations, or 20 pairs, and they recorded them. And they just measured how long it took between how long the silence was between when one person stopped talking and the other started. And they found that it was a very short gap. How short do you think it was in the average gap? You understand the gap? How short do you think they found?
3 seconds.
Hmm?
3 seconds.
3 seconds. It's a tenth of a second.
Oh.
A tenth of a second. So let's understand now what these conversations are like with a tenth of a second gap. You're listening to someone talk. If you're going to get back in a tenth of a second, you're going to have to start thinking about a lot of things while the other person is still talking. What are they saying? What does it mean to them? What does it mean to me? How am I going to respond? And so on. So here is this internal drama going on to the point that you can't really listen to what the person is saying. You've got too much business to attend to. See, little boys find this out when they're 6 years old. If they don't respond quickly, they say, "What's the matter with you? Are you stupid?" You don't want to be called stupid. So they learn to respond. And the way to do that, the only way I can think of doing it, is by not really listening to the intricacies of what the person is saying, what feelings they might have with it, and so on. This is speed talking, not speed dating. So I wonder what would happen in, let's say, your closest relationship if you had a rule that you're going to listen for 1 minute. That's 100 times slower. That would slow it down, the gap, 100 times. And that maybe you could learn more about what the other person is thinking and feeling that way. See, our society presses us very, very strongly on the issue of being an individual. of showing off your understanding very quickly, and it turns out, I think, without really listening. So it's a complicated matter, connectedness, and it's never really been directly studied. I've published a paper based on their finding, and there's been a lot of very interest shown in it. But it's an important issue. And it reaches into many areas, for example, the area of love, not just hatred, but love. How can you love someone that you don't really understand and they don't understand you? What does love mean without that sort of deep understanding? Any other questions or comments?
Thank you, Tom. I was wondering if you could say something about why you think these sorts of mass killings are so much more common in the United States than in other countries. And related to that, whether you've thought about sort of the contagion effects of these events.
Contagion.
Yeah.
The United States is one of the countries that started earliest with industrialization, urbanization, and individuation. Not as early as England, however, so it's kind of a puzzle to me why there are not as many mass killings in England as there are here, because England started first. But the United States came along. So it's about over-individualization, I think, even though it doesn't fit the situation perfectly because of the English example. Traditional societies, they overemphasize the social bond. And that has had destructive consequences on their keeping up with the industrial countries. Because I think invention and creation is largely an individual matter. Committees don't do very well with creativity. So the West has gotten way ahead of traditional societies, but we've gone way too far. So finding the mark, the middle ground, between isolation in the West, in industrial societies, and what might be called engulfment, being caught up, so caught up in other people you can't really use your creative facilities. There has to be some middle ground, and that's what I think we need to look for. Did that answer your whole question?
The contagion
effect. I haven't thought about much about that. I'm sure there is some of it. I haven't looked into it. The manifestos and letters I've read haven't mentioned being spurred on by other instance, but that doesn't mean it's not happening. I can't answer your question.
So if I understand sort of the theory correctly, that the mass shootings are an expression of rage that's largely connected to alienation from the group. So on a sort of societal level, we expect like higher levels in places and times with greater amounts of this individuation, right? My question is there research that you know of that looks at this as kind of a broader phenomenon? In other words, we only see mass shootings because of a certain body count, right? That defines it as like mass shooting, right? So obviously that has a lot to do with the capacity to inflict a certain level of damage, right? But is there sort of a broader sort of model or set of data or analyses that would look at more of a range of behaviors in which this is an extreme example, right? But so I'm asking in a sense two things. One is, are there ways that rage is captured and channeled in socially acceptable ways in societies that are more individuated, right? And is there research that could support the argument even in contexts not like the United States, where there's this obviously this extreme ability to get the to get weapons and to inflict this damage?
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know of such studies, but they should be, and there of course there must be less extreme kinds of aggression than mass killing, but you could apply it to murders of a single person, and suicide too. I would expect the suicide to be on the withdrawal, the shame. I don't know of such studies, but they should be done because you get much larger numbers. This fellow who studied familicide, he had what is for me a very large number of cases, 211, I think. And he had an interesting finding, a separation between two kinds of killers. The majority, they killed in a fit of rage. They were almost all men. And they had a history of aggression and violence. No surprise there. But there was a substantial minority, which had men and women, who had no history of violence or aggression or even anger. A typical case would be a man who's very proud of his job and being a good breadwinner. He loses his job. Well, he goes home and doesn't tell anybody and pretends to just keep going to work. Goes out every morning with his briefcase. But what he's doing is plotting to kill. He's going to kill everybody, often including himself. That looks a lot like humiliation hidden under rage. Hidden not only from others, but also from himself. He's not feeling the humiliation. If he could, he could talk about it and talk through it. So that's relevant to your question, but we do need much broader research than just these extreme cases. I mean, ordinary murders, we get thousands of cases very easily, and that should be done. And also the other side of it, how people work with anger, the people who get rid of it. There are angry people out there, and it doesn't seem to bother them. See, this comes back to the problem of study of emotions being so new. Emotion studiers don't even agree on what an emotion is and what the basic emotions are and how to define them. Anger, for example. And then I think the majority of them, if a therapist said, well, what will I do with anger? And they say, well, vent. Have them vent the anger. Well, what do you mean? Well, when they're in your office, put down a pillow and give them a tennis racket and scream at them and beat on it. Well, I tried that, doesn't work for me. It makes things worse. What I've found is that if I can just not yell at the person who yells at me, but explain why I'm angry in a civil way, that doesn't end the quarrel, but it makes it very brief. But if I yell back, throw away the rest of the day, you know. So there's no agreement. Emotions are a foreign body to most, even the researchers. I was going to tell you about another study. It'll come to me tonight when I'm trying to go to sleep. Other question? See, the idea of hidden shame offends the public idea of emotion. The public equates emotion and feeling. And even some of the words, he's ashamed. The word means that not only is he in a state of shame, but he also feels it. The very word, English is the worst in this way. There are some languages which are much better about emotions. The Romance languages, for example, they do something that English doesn't do with shame. They use the same word for embarrassment and shame, vergüenza in Spanish. And that's very important that they make that connection, because in English people won't think, no, embarrassment is okay, but let's not talk about shame. So the Romance languages are far ahead in that respect and in some others. There is one tiny language in the South Seas in New Zealand, Maori, extremely sophisticated about emotions. I mean, they could write my book, or if they looked at my book, they'd say, well, this is no news. We already know this. I think Chinese, at least classical Mandarin Chinese, there's a symbol for shame anger. You can say it in Chinese. You can't say it. It's awkward in English. Shame anger. What are you talking about? Shame anger. Either shame or anger. Sorry. But so the more traditional societies are less. Have become less detached from emotions than the modern societies, and because the modern societies think that behavior and perception and cognition, certainly, these are crucial, and that's what's been studied for hundreds of years, and we just started studying emotions seriously maybe less than 50 years ago. Oh, I wanted to tell you about Helen's book. When I read there about the sequence from shame to anger and then not talking about the shame, I thought, well, you know, we've got to meet this woman because that's my case, you know, like that's me. That explains my fits of rage. And so we first phoned her and later wrote letters, but finally we went to see her. At Yale, she was at Yale, and followed her to her country place with her husband, and then talked to her as long as she was willing. We followed her around several summers like puppy dogs, trying to learn what she knew about emotions, which was quite a lot. And I've just finished an article about her book, this 1971 book, and I gave the talk to a Copenhagen group conference in Copenhagen. It was a keynote talk on this book, and they liked it. And it was the humanities people, which is a first for me. Usually the humanities people, they don't want to hear from a sociologist. That's a kind of joke word there. But they liked it, and they want to hear more about these specific emotions. Helen's daughter is still alive. She's a psychiatrist, and she is helping me with this article about her mother's book. Have we run out of gas? The sequencing of anger and shame into discussion is a very tricky thing. The therapist has to know how to keep his mouth shut or her mouth shut, because the client is likely to be very restrained in talking about these things, especially the shame, because they often feel that shame is shaming, even to talk about it. And so it's clear to me from my own experience, both as a client and as a therapist. I didn't mention I had a therapist license for a while. When I first discovered the world of emotions, I got so excited that I got my psychiatrist to grandfather me into a marriage family therapy license. And so I saw a lot of clients under his benevolent tutorage. I was a terrible therapist, I think. Actually, I had an experience in therapy in which I thought I was a good therapist, but it turned out not to be the case. I was part of a team that gave intensives here in Santa Barbara. There was a very skillful and experienced social worker near Marilyn Nadler, who lives now in Santa Cruz, and she had the idea of responding to the therapists in L.A. who had trouble with therapists, with their clients, sending the client to her for 40 hours of therapy. She called it an intensive. So what that meant was, instead of talking to her on the phone about it and then trying it on the client, they would talk to her on the phone about it, and then she would get me and two other ignorant therapists together to help her take off some of the slack of the 40 hours. 2.5 hours of individual therapy with the four of us, that should be 20 hours, and 20 hours of group therapy in groups in town. And we had 81 cases like that, and lo and behold, everyone worked. No failures. And of course, the therapists in L.A. were like astounded, like, what did you do? And she would say, I don't know, I just did what needed to be done. So for years afterwards, she moved to Santa Cruz. I was pestering her. I said, Marilyn, what's the formula? How did you know? What did you do? She said, I don't know, I just know. So I finally accepted the idea that she was an intuitive person. She knew what to do intuitively. She couldn't explain it. There was no formula. Well, while we were going hot and heavy with these 81 clients, us three amateurs thought we were wonderful therapists because she was coaching us in a very subtle way about what to do and say with these clients. And so we thought we were helping solve all these difficult cases. But we tried to continue after she left the Santa Cruz. It didn't work. We were helpless without her. So that's where I learned, by the way, that not only does venting anger doesn't work with me, but it doesn't work with most other people. Occasionally it's helpful. Someone who smiles all the time, mostly women, but occasionally I've known a man who's a smiler, you get them to vent and yell and scream and say no, and it's a big production then. It makes them feel like a new person. But that's very rare. It just doesn't work with most people. And so after I read Helen's book and had my wife explain it to me in psychoanalytic jargon, I started using looking at the shame behind the anger, and that was much more productive as a therapist.
My question is about students here, undergrads, and kind of moving forward, and maybe some practical. I know you have a deep connection with Isla Vista, and having been here with the students, and you know the community very well. And I'm thinking, do you have any sort of practical suggestions about what I'll just a little background, because I was teaching a large number of students in the spring. I know that there's just a great sense of, and even to this today, you know, when I was trying to recommend that students come to this talk, I think there's a sense of denial on one hand, and on another hand, just a sense of futility, I think, about such things. So I'm wondering if maybe you could speak a little bit to the students, the undergrads, to the community of Isla Vista, maybe some, if you have any practical suggestions about sort of things, directions forward.
Yes, yes. I would love to have classes try out the speed friending as part of the class. That is, have students learn what it's like to make a new friend and the advantages and the disadvantages and so on. So speed friending, you could do it in any class as part of the class program, and then you could ask them about what it is they're doing and why would they be doing this ridiculous thing, and have it going on all over campus. Speed friending is just one approach. Another approach that's been tried, I think, already many times, is this idea of cooperative teaching, cooperative learning, where you have teams and you grade the team. My son-in-law has two children in the Carmel Valley schools who are in the school. It's dominated by that. And my son has some reservations about what happens when cooperative grading. But nevertheless, you know, he doesn't dismiss it. He just says, well, you know, there's some difficulties about the smartest student doing all the work and the others getting the credit for it. But I think he's a little irritable on that point. But anything, any direction that would relieve some of the isolation between the students. See, this gets a little tricky because some of that work is being done by sororities and fraternities. They do a kind of speed friending, institutionalized. But on the other hand, they're rejecting a lot of people at the same time. So I don't know how much they would like to talk about this issue, about their responsibility not only for accepting members, but for rejecting people as not members. I mean, that could get very touchy very quickly. But it's something that we need to discuss. Does that make sense? Does this seem practical that you could introduce the idea of getting closer to your fellow students, as well as learning something from the in the direction, the general direction of the course? There's a universal kind of learning that can go on in all classes, beginning into first grade, and the trick would be to find something that won't be rejected immediately, saying, oh, that's ridiculous, at the same time that will have some of this connectedness developed.
I think that all makes perfect sense to me, and yet I find it just somehow very ironic or paradoxical that we are now in this moment of such high interaction and socializing and with the internet, Facebook, and tweeting and all of this, that we're in a moment of much higher sort of social interaction than ever before in some ways, I would say. And somewhere like Isla Vista is just a community that has just a high level of, you know, getting together, right, in many different ways. And so the solution to create the more opportunities to make friends in a way seems to me like, I don't know, I'm just throwing it out there kind of for everybody in some way. It seems like, is that the issue, really?
You see, that's a very good point. Because unless you explain them to them, to people, they won't understand what you mean by friendship. It'll be their definition of friendship. But we have to explain that friendship goes further than just meeting them once in a while and talking. That there is that we're social beings, and that we need to connect in this direct and in a way that we're not accustomed to doing since we've been babies. You know, the baby makes has to make a good connection at least with the mom. But friendship has a double meaning. There's a sociological meaning that we're talking about here, and especially a social psychological meaning of understanding what people are thinking and feeling even when they don't say it. See, that's really important, because often people find it difficult to say what's bothering them or to express it or to want to say it. See, what'll you think of me if I tell you that I'm ashamed that I don't wear socks to work? So there's a whole like enormous train of the universe that we're talking about here and the meaning of friendship. And you can say the same thing about love. You know, that English dictionaries define, they give you 26 meanings of love. 26 meanings? What could it mean? Which one of the meanings? Some of the meanings are a little bit contradictory. So essentially in English, especially in English, love doesn't mean anything in particular. It means 26 things, so you don't know when you say, do you love me? We should be saying, well, what do you mean? What does that mean to you? I'll tell you what it means to me. And what it means to me is that not only, you know, do you like the person and you like being around them and you help them and try to do good by them, but you're attuned with them. That's what love means to me. And that's just as important as any of the rest. Attunement means, it's a little embarrassing to tell you this, so if I blush, you'll understand, but it's very complicated. Attunement gets very complicated. It means if you know something and I know it, I know that you know it and you know that I know it, and I know that you know that I know it, and so on. That's what attunement means. Well, try telling that to a student. They'll laugh you right out of class. But that's what it means. It's complicated. Human beings are extremely complicated, and we have great needs and things we need, and that's one of them. We need to be attuned or be able to find attunement with at least one other person in the world so that we don't think we're alone in the world. And then with that, I think we can say goodbye and thank you for coming. You've been a very good audience.
Thank you, Tommy. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.